sweeping emotional tides ebb and flow through history. One generation can see no light at the end of its tunnel, almost loses sight of the meaning of progress, of social improvement, and the best spirits of that generation cultivate a determined discipline, a stoic control of their will. They will not be broken by life. And the average spirit in that generation becomes cynical. Power, privilege, and the ways in which all men go about conducting their business. Another generation will also be pessimistic of change, fail to see the possibilities implicit in their generation. But they will be buoyed up by a great confident hope that somehow from the outside, the gods or God will bring about an apocalyptic transformation. The messianic age will dawn. The best spirits of that age leave the city and leave their preoccupations and prepare themselves spiritually for the new age. And the average person is simply encouraged by the fact that sages and teachers and priests tell him that the time, the glorious time, is at hand. And there are still other ages in which men are buoyed up by a kind of surging confidence. Have a feeling that all is well, that there are no problems which cannot be surmounted, no obstacles which cannot be overcome, that somehow men united will do away with the ancient ills of society. And the best spirits of this age are the social reformers and crusaders of the world. The average man of this age feels himself moving up the ladder of success, encouraged by his mobility. One of the fascinating opportunities of history is a chance to describe the changing moods of men. And it's something more than idle research. Because if we become sensitive how the philosophies and the attitudes of other ages have been conditioned by their emotional preconceptions, how what passes for wisdom is very little more usually than a rationalization of the generation's emotional mood, then perhaps we can gain some insight into our own generation, for here too, we also are prone to assume that the attitudes which are conditioned by the environment, the way of looking at things which is uniquely ours, is in fact the true way. And that the preconceptions about life and the future which school and family and the media impose upon us are in fact the way to understand what life truly is. If we want to keep our heads above the roiling waters, then somehow we must find a perch from which to have our own judgment. And that can come only when we can define the tides of feeling, the tides of attitude, which run under our age, and judge them for what they are, rather than accept them as simply the truth. I have no other purpose this morning than to attempt to chart for you one of the great currents of feeling which surges through our history. And I'd like to suggest to you this morning that we are at a time when the heavy tide of despair, of anguish, of doubt and of disillusion is beginning to sweep through our history. Most of us tend to wonder whether there is a future. Can civilization survive? The headlines are black. Our literature is bleak, delighting in detailing for us the ordinary, the rather banal vulgarities of men. The poets sing, "The bright day is done, we are for the dark." And the average man, the ordinary man, looks about him at his cities choked with people, covered by filth, overlaid by violence, And he wonders. He shakes his head. And he sighs. Is this really what life, the future, is all about? Is there really hope? And the shrug is quite a meaningful one, for it bespeaks his philosophy. Alo Navi Anochi Velo Ben Navi. I'm not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. I cannot describe for you the future. I cannot tell you what it will be like, of what it will be made. But I'd like to suggest to you that if we can understand whether the sense of haplessness, whether the sense of hopelessness, whether the sense of doom and damnation is fact or fancy, whether it's simply an emotional moment, tide, or whether it corresponds to the truth, will make a great difference in our lives. For if, in fact, there is no future, if, in fact, we are simply carrying on as men have always carried on until that awful day of the Holocaust, then how different would our lives really be? Would we bring children into the world to a premature death? Why defer pleasures? Why build for the future if there's no future? Why hold on to duties and disciplines if they cannot make for progress and social change? Now, some have already answered these questions, as we do not like to see them answered. They have become careless of time. They have become indifferent to duty. Why? To what purpose is the duty? What will be accomplished? Today, tomorrow, next month, next year, it'll all end. And so there are those who, what's the current phrase, drop out. And there are those who abandon their place in society. And we too wonder. And we too doubt. Can civilization survive? How much of the pessimism of today is merited? How much is simply a surge of anguish, of fear? That's a particularly interesting question, because we have stood and lived through one of the great watersheds of human feeling. There are those here this morning who can remember a far more hopeful and confident age, when men assumed that they had been placed upon the earth, dowered by a kind God with gifts of hand and of heart and hand and mind, which would allow them to overcome any problem, to solve any social crisis, to push back the outer perimeter of ignorance, of darkness, to gain for man control over the mysteries of nature so that man would build upon the earth a decent society for decent men. We rather looked upon ourselves as white-coated men in the laboratory, the Curies, the Pasteurs of the world, performing miracle after miracle, each miracle opening a new door of possibility into a brighter tomorrow. Throughout the 19th and the early part of the 20th century, a long wave of optimism surged through our history. And well it might, for there seemed to be no accomplishment which was beyond human capacity. The century began with political revolutions, the American Revolution, the French Revolution, proclaiming great new doctrines of liberation, freedom, equality, fraternity, constitutionalism. Men had hoped that at long last the age of special privilege and special power was at an end. Then we had the great productive triumphs of the Industrial Revolution, wherein the middle class and many in the lower class suddenly had the amenities, the things which only the Caesars of old had enjoyed. We controlled the infectious diseases. We doubled man's lifespan. We gave to our children the opportunity for mass literacy and for a good education. The economy of scarcity came an economy of adequacy. For the first time, we looked upon government as something more than a system of repression which saw to it that the class structure which existed in the society necessarily had to persist. There was now enough for the many, were simply a question of men of goodwill joining together in common purpose. There was no cesspool left over from the medieval world which would somehow not dry up under the sunlight of the new age and of man's new sense of power and of capacity and control. Men walked confidently, and they walked confidently away from the traditional ties of family and clan and tradition which had sustained them through the dark days of the Middle Ages. And they walked confidently away from the traditional duties which they looked upon as archaic, as too limiting. There was a bright, new, open future. Let's be free. It was a grand time. Man walked proudly. He walked as if he were God. Then we began to think we were gods. One can chart this mood very interestingly in the essays and the preachings of the last generations. I read to you deliberately this morning from the first chapter of the book of Isaiah. The liberal pulpit, whatever its religious affiliation, echoed and declared as sacred the emotional feelings which men already felt. Now, there was nothing pietistic about these pulpits. They knew exactly where the ills were that society suffered from. They knew that there were the greedy men and the selfish men and the ambitious men. They knew that many classes were struggling to retain all that they had had in the past. And they pointed their finger and they summoned men to a crusade against those who opposed unionism and those who opposed universal education and those who opposed the income tax and those who opposed responsibilities throughout the world. These were pulpits of courage and pulpits of conviction. And they cited again and again the great stern ethical requirements of the prophets. Cease to do evil, learn to do well, establish freedom in the land, establish justice in the gates. And many responded, pulpit and pew, the writer and the reader, went out to do battle for the Lord. And they went out confidently, for they read also in the prophets that it shall come to pass in the end of days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established as the top of the mountains and shall be exalted among the hills. And in that glorious time, they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. Do the right. Do the good. Be citizens of quality and of courage, and the utopian days will open. They are near. Join together, citizens of goodwill, of all persuasions and of all attitudes, and you can create a city of decency and of amenity. You can create a nation of justice and of freedom. You can establish world government and peace. That was the hope. And that was the teaching that was declared to be sacred. But unfortunately, there was a great middle term in the prophetic teaching which was overlooked in the readings and overlooked in the texts. Yes, the prophets preached a stern ethic. Cease to do evil. Learn to do good. Proclaim freedom unto the land. Establish justice in the gates. Yes, the prophets taught that if men ceased to do evil and learned to do good, there would be a good time. There would be a good society. There would be peace and justice. They also felt, and they were freighted and burdened with this feeling, that men would not take advantage of the opportunity which was theirs. Because the commandment was not a simple one. Give a few dollars to the United Appeal. Pay your taxes. It was one which demanded a radical transformation of the individual. A man who had ceased to be self-involved and being totally involved in the community. A man who would not rationalize his own advantage as that which was socially advantageous. They knew that though they spoke God's word, the command, the people had eyes, but they see not, and ears, but they hear not, their heart was heavy and sodden with excess flesh. And so the prophets spoke of hope, but underscored their certain feeling that the nation would fall short and would be punished and sent into exile and destroyed. And what about these great visions of the future, when every man shall sin under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid? Yes, they were great visions of the future. In the end of days is part of the messianic vocabulary of the prophets. No prophet ever had the idea, really, that you and I, of our own efforts, would construct and architect and sculpt and build a society which was just and peaceful. This would be God's work in the end of times. They had no belief in the slow ascent of man. History was a straight line until God, in his own good time and for his own good reasons, Baharit HaYamim, at the end of days, would suddenly interfere in history and bring about that condition for which all men dream. The prophets hardly qualify as 19th, 20th century optimists, social liberals. But we read them for what we wanted them to say. We read them to encourage us in our labors and to give us a sense that a new day truly was dawning, and that was what God had created this world to be all about. Well, this mood of hope and of confidence produced some very dramatic results. Medicine, science, human thought. It encouraged men to set out to live by a stern, ethical sense of duty. But early in this century, we began to realize that the inevitability of progress, the sense of the immediate accomplishment by man of decency in his society, would simply not come about. Look at the face of the 19th century. There are essentially two. And they both are confident, overly confident. One is communism, the new faith of the century. Of what does it speak? Of the inevitable triumph of the great accomplishments of the proletariat, of the inevitability of the socialist vision. And in our own version of 19th century faith, the American version, of what did we speak? Of the inevitability of the American dream. That somehow, functionally, rationally, pragmatically, humanistically, men of all creeds and races in this country would unite together, given the opportunity which was ours, and we would bring about the flowering of a gracious and great society. And the key word in all these faiths was possibility, almost inevitability. But now men had to recognize in the 20th century progress is not inevitable, that the great triumphs of the laboratory do not necessarily translate into triumphs in the city, triumphs in social living. And I suppose that the watershed of these feelings of hope and confidence, the beginning of the returning tide of pessimism and despair, was the First World War. A stupid war, a foolish war, a war which was not fought for any basic reason or principle, a bloody war, 10 million died, a war which was written as a history of the futility and of the cupidity of human beings, those who call themselves statesmen and diplomats, and the folly of citizens who followed their banners and their leaders for the fatherland or for the mother country. But that was in Europe, far away. And Americans, by and large, continue to hold on to this naive sense of optimism and of confidence well into the 1920s, even through the Great Depression. That was only a, well, we would overcome it. We created a new deal. We were certain we could organize our way out of it. But then in the 1930s, a series of blows which none could blink away descended upon the world. There was Manchuria, the Japanese invasion of China. There was Ethiopia. There was the Spanish Civil War. There was the German march into Czechoslovakia and into Poland. There was Auschwitz, and Dachau, Majdanek, and Treblinka, and 20 million dead, and half a continent reduced to rubble. And now men really had to come to grips with their own role in the creation of the society for which they dreamed. Were we adequate to control the power which our minds had given into our hands? In the 19th century, men had talked of evolution, and they assumed that man's moral and spiritual capacities would evolve, would progress, would grow, even as his power grew. The thought of the 20th century, beginning with Freud, has forced us to ask a much more bitter question. Can we ever begin to transcend the animal, the instinctual in our behavior? Is there anything besides rationalization, sham, and pretense which makes us human beings? Something more than creatures of greed and creatures of lust? That's the debate. And the answer is not yet clear. All the gods to whom we bowed so confidently have brought us violence as well as opportunity. Medicine brought us overpopulation. Science offered us the bomb. Technology has given us the means, the computers, the electronic devices with which we can invade privacy and control people. Industry has given us pollution. All of our gods have proven that their power is awesome, not necessarily beneficial. And man, can modern man sing confidently that he's but little lower than the angels, crowned with glory, with honor? Do we not have to look again at the prophets and find the lost, missing middle term? Recognize we have eyes, but we see not, and ears, but we hear not. Nivar kol adam midat. That somehow every man is insensitive, brutish, lacking in a willingness to respond to the urgencies of the hour. What's for it, then? The mood we know. It's black, bleak. It's one which encourages men to drop out into their hippie pads or suburban plots, to give up, to despair. And our literature prepares us almost to expect heavier and heavier blows tomorrow, destroys for us any and all illusion. And our art forces us to see nature not in its beauty, but cut up, destroyed, even as our cities are sprawling over the earth and destroying it. And we no longer have the rationalizations we might have had a decade ago, or two decades ago, that somehow there's a criminal element in us, that we're pure, we're the men of goodwill, we are those who can and will cooperate for the good of our city, but that there are the others, the pathological, the Hitlers, the Stalins, the criminals who live someplace in the city and who permit the acts of murder and of violence, the Southerners with their dogs and with their police to enforce their rules of segregation. But now we have to admit that we too somehow caught up in this whole maelstrom of evil. We, our government, we dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The banality of evil was not only proved in Nuremberg, it was proved in the atomic ash of those cities. And what is the hidden tragedy of the war in Vietnam? It's that we, those of us who held on to the American dream, it's that we can defoliate the forest and we can dry up the land so it cannot produce. And we do it with all the noblest of rationalizations in a sense of duty. But so did the stormtrooper. So did the young member of the Communist Party. And here we are, men and women of goodwill in our own city. We ought, we think, to be capable of sitting down together and rationally and reasonably work out the problems of the city. Have we? Is our city what it was 30 years ago or 40 years ago? We cower to walk the streets. We know that we are breathing cancerous agents. It's not anybody, any criminal who has pushed these into the air. It's the respectable leaders of our city conducting respectable businesses according to a respectable American formula. Stripped, naked, suddenly aware of his own animality, suddenly cynical about all the great words of history, freedom, justice, righteousness, brotherhood, cooperation, we despair. We are caught up by the tide of pessimism. Is that all there is to life? The sense that the times are getting dark, the bright day is done, that we are all for the dark. I asked a class of young people a few weeks ago, can civilization survive? Half of them said no. But none of them said to me, that's a foolish question. Can civilization survive? Not if we give in to the sense that it is lost. Those who give in to it, and their actions can be traced in the last generation, those who give in to it are given to irrational acts, to turning against society, to a violence of language, to a contempt of the necessary, reasonable ways in which social reform and social revolution, in fact, do take place. What should encourage us? What can allow us to hold our heads above this surging tide of frustration? Well, in the first instance, the fact that our world has changed. We have, in the last 75 or 100 years, created and brought into being the greatest social economic revolution mankind has ever known. We've almost turned the economic pyramid end on end. Time was when economics was the dismal science. There was enough only for the few, and the many necessarily had to be kept with inadequacy. And then we produced a world in which many could share relatively equally. And we've brought a concomitant political revolution into being, where many can share in the business of government, and government need not simply be the imposition of authority from above, law and order to see that the plebes, the natives, the serfs, the laborer is kept in line. And we have brought health and healing to our bodies. And we have brought about an educational revolution where all of our children can be trained up to the limits of their capacity. Much has happened, but not enough. And we took advantage of the change. We took advantage of our industry, of our science, of our power. But we did not always use our minds to watch carefully, to prevent abuse, to create the new laws, the new philosophy, which will allow us to understand the dimensions of the revolution and to use it advantageously. What am I saying? I'm saying simply this. Civilization can survive. We may squeak through. We have new powers. We still have our capacities. There are still those who live saintly lives, whose lives are devoted to service to others, to VISTA, to the Peace Corps, to their city. But unfortunately, most of us listen to these Jeremiads, listen to these analyses of the time, even as our forefathers did in Judah 2900 years ago, and nod our head in agreement, and that's the beginning and the end of it. Our lives are continued on the exact same basis in which they were before. Why do we have a new surge of radicalism in America? Because the urgency is apparent to all who are not blind. Because to do things as we have always done them, 99% for ourselves, 1% for our community, provided it's tax deductible, is not to do anything. Because to continue to build our lives towards professional success, towards social achievement, towards the gaining of respectability, is to continue a way of life which is no longer viable in the seventh decade of the 20th century. There's only a very narrow opening in the door into the future. There are tremendous problems in building a decent future. To continue politics as usual, society as usual, business as usual, education as usual, religion as usual, is to guarantee we will not get there. The time is now. The needs are urgent. We used our powers to unlock the secrets of nature. I am convinced that we could use our powers to unlock the secrets of our own resources, to unlock the chance of creating a new lifestyle, a new dedication, a new set of priorities, a new set of commitments. But I confess also that I hear many speeches urging this, and I see very little evidence of it. Like the tides of history, we come, we hear, and we go. And like the prophets of history, we speak, we urge, we are burdened with a terrible sense of the shadows. Amen.